believe we've got quorum. Let me run down the roles to make sure I've got everyone on. If you refresh your page, then it should say that we've got Pat Hayes, Joel Bender, Peter Yim, Steve Ray, Howard Mason, Frank Oken, and Ed Bachmeyer. Anyone else on the call that we've missed so far? No? And we should
all disappearing.
Right. We should be also be expecting David Price, Chip Masters, and Bobbin T. Garden.
Bobbin, yeah.
Okay. Right. So.
Did you see that email from Dave Price saying that he might be able to dial in and listen, but
exactly.
Can't
yeah. Right. Originally, I had him as co-chair. Now, Ed Bachmeyer is co-chair. Frank and Ed, take it away and get us started. Since I don't believe we have a lot of presentation material or written up material available online so far, I suggest people get onto the chat board and then when we go to the specific sections or items, then each person sort of document their own status and commitments and so on, and that becomes our proceeding.
Yeah, I'm still not sure as to what exactly you want us to do, Peter.
Okay, today we are just trying to go through where we stand on each of these six things, and if we're lucky, they've all been drafted out, and we will review and try to do some preliminary alignment. If we don't have these drafts, at least we review and see what the status is, where we stand, and what needs to happen between now and October 30th, I guess. That sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Let's start with that. Scopes.
Okay.
So I guess on your plate.
Yeah. You do want me to keyboard anything, or you just want me to just... What you want me to do is make sure it's in the chat session notes, right? While we do this.
First of all, I mean, we can talk about it and then capture the essence into the chat session
okay,
notes
got
yourself.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure out. Okay, yeah.
But of course, the verbal should be much more elaborate. I mean, just capture the essence into the chat.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. First of all, we have a list of scope issues which are actually on the one of the pages that we had a couple of on Monday's conference call. We have a page that has the scope issues that we had, and I have added, I've expanded on a couple of those. What I have at the moment is half a slide set that has the scope issues. I should be done certainly by tomorrow. My original intent was to be done by today, but yesterday disappeared. The issues that were there are simply, in effect, being expanded in a couple of places where there are a whole bunch of sub-issues that we can address or not address depending on how much time we want to spend. Also, I mean, if the major heading goes, all of the sub-issues go, so we don't have to worry about that. There is also a scope statement that is the scope for the TC that is in Howard's draft, and that's obviously sort of an abbreviated scope statement that describes the major concepts that are going to be in the specification. The only really critical one that is the very first issue on the list is are we not going to do a quantities model? I think pretty much everybody has agreed, well, with the exception of the UCUM folk, I think, that you need a quantities model in order to produce a semantics for the units model. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to have units without quantities. But we really have to get everybody in the room to say, yeah, that's the situation, or those who insist that it's not the case to realize that they've lost and go away. The second issue that is going to show up pretty fast is this one about how much are we going to do in the line of explicit named units and explicit named quantity kinds. There's an infinite supply of derived quantity kinds, and there's an infinite supply of derived units. And obviously we're not going to do every derived unit or every unit we can think of. The question is, how many are we going to do directly? How many are we going to model explicitly? And how many are, and what are we going to do about the others? How do we deal with the ones? In effect, we'll have an ontology in which we know what kind of thing they are, but the individuals will not be documented in our ontology directly. And in that case, we need to talk about where they're going to be, where we can find them, and whether there's a standard conversion from, for example, the UCUM list.
Can I comment?
Sure.
But then there is a maintenance issue. When it is all in natural language, of course, you can just refer to something else, and it's also in natural language, and that gets incorporated. But when our normative standard is in common logic or in OWL, it does not automatically import. So if we leave out those individuals, who is going to do the maintenance? I mean, to keep the standard up to date.
Well, that goes to the issue that Howard referred to before as registration authorities and something of that form. It's the maintenance of a reference information base. And clearly, if we go that route, Peter, you're absolutely right. We would have to have, not only do you have to have essentially a standard means of conversion, unless if those things aren't stored in the reference base in CLIF or OWL, but you also have to have a tool that does it. You have to be able to refer to this thing and assume that and have a tool that in effect will materialize that element of your ontology from the information base. That's not impossible to do. It's an interesting thing to think about. But it probably is the kind of thing we're going to need to do. At least in my head, that's what I would expect will happen. As you don't. The alternative is that you just assume that somewhere along the way, people will extend this model with the units and publish those extensions so that people can pick up the extensions as well. But it you're right. I mean, we cannot in the model directly make reference to things that aren't themselves in an appropriate logical form. So, and even if we do, even if we try to refer to these things, I don't know how to do this sort of automatic extension idea. I know that there are people who have RDF triple bases that are, in some cases, not really there, and that the Sparkle queries can, in fact, actually access an underlying SQL database, which is materializing, which materializes RDF triples to match the elements that are actually selected out of the database. I suspect that something like that is what we would end up actually doing if we try to use something like a UCUM. You're right on. This is an issue, and we need to hit this issue head on, which is this issue about individual quantities and what we're going to do about that.
Is agreement to those changes, which means you're not doing a registration authority task, because technically that means that anything that obeys the rules gets in automatically. Or what you're doing is actually much closer to a maintenance agency, and you're configuration controlling the growth of integrated ontology with agreed chunks of extension to do new issues.
Yeah, my question is more of, I agree with Howard. My question is more of, where does our scope end? Is this in scope or out of scope?
That's the question.
Yes.
That's why it's a scope issue, Peter. I really, you've hit upon it. There is a level of what we're actually going to define directly in the model. And the question is, and the remaining question is, and what are we going to do about all the things we don't define directly in the model? I think that's
Ed.
Sorry, Frank. Yeah.
Yeah. So, there are two things. There are things like, there are extensions which are just multiplications or divisions of units, which should be processable automatically. But I, if I understand what you're saying, you're saying that, for example, you want the ability to create new named units like watts, or let's say joules, which is Newton meter seconds, right?
But it's not just the ability to do it. We will certainly have the ability to do it, I would think, in the model. I mean, you want to have a means of derivation. That is an issue. But I assume that's in. The issue isn't whether, from my point of view, the issue isn't whether there is a way to create one. Because if that happens, it means that, you know, everybody who is going to do a physics model is going to end up having to define joules and watts and whatever if
well,
there's
you,
no reference
you don't
for
don't want
it.
To do that. You want to have a
right.
whole bunch of those recorded.
Exactly. That's the point, okay? And that's the sort of thing that the UCUM does. It's got this library of defined symbols and the, quote, definitions, which are done in the units algebra, but, you know, but ignoring that, the point is that we would want something, I think, like that. That's what I was heading for. Is surely we will need to specify, which goes to Howard's point, we would need to specify a mechanism for definition. But the problem is you also want to vet those things, and Howard is right. I mean, you don't want just the RA kind of thing which says, you know, if you submit one of these according to the rules, it automatically goes in. What you want is somebody whose job is to maintain is a maintained list that somehow has an approval authority scheme for getting things in there. And there's, you know, the trouble is much of that is beyond our competence, but there are people like the UCUM who already believe they are doing exactly that, and therefore the idea would be to derive somehow directly from what they've got.
Right. Well, indeed, there are mechanisms now that you probably are yet familiar with within ISO at least for managing a standard as a database with a validation team that will be able to pick up exactly the sorts of changes you're talking about. That's even easier, by the way, than doing a new edition in OASIS.
Right. Well, you don't want to have to do a new edition because you want to be able to do this incrementally, as people say, you know, we need this unit and that unit and the other thing. But I think that it's either got to be a ISO registration authority of some sort or maintenance authority, if that's what you're calling it. Or it has to be an organization like NIST.
It's a registration authority.
What?
The 30-second difference between those, maintenance agencies review and get approval for the changes. A registration authority has to accept anything that obeys the rules that have been set.
Oh,
so
then I think you want a maintenance authority.
So maintenance agency, registration authority. Those are the specific terms. We now actually have a third way that looks like a lightweight maintenance agency, which if you look in the ISO IEC directives, it's Annex FT. We're using it in FC4 for both reference data and indeed sets of data modules. And it's quite a nice lightweight procedure for making incremental changes without going to the hassle of a new edition.
I mean, if I might interject, there's also a completely different way of thinking about this, which I think is more in the spirit of the web, in which rather than sort of maintaining something that's definitive and approved and sort of guarding it against craziness, what one does is publish something which is deliberately designed to be extended by others and to simply publish it and have others publish the extension under their own authority, but which if they cite or in the appropriate sense import our standard, then that imposes a certain structure on what they do. So that the you know, if someone wanted to publish a test of units with watts in it, they would simply say this is an extension to the UOM ontology, and by saying that they have thereby, as it were, accepted the normative parts of our ontology, including as in this idea, the extension mechanisms that they claim to be using to extend it. But we're not obliged to maintain what they publish.
I would actually
expect that to happen within ASHRAE and for the world of HVAC, air conditioning. That there are a bunch of units in there that are relatively specific to that world. And it would be great for them to be able to say, this is, PSI differential versus PSI relative versus PSI something, and have all those things specific in their extensions to the basic standard units.
Right.
And then they maintain their own, ASHRAE maintains its own library through its own standards process, but they use basically the same set of cooperative tools of being able to annotate and publish what the content is. So.
But I think the core sets of units, watts, joule, all the major SI units, at least, I think need to be in some official or at least standard-based organization, and I think it would be NIST, or it could be BIPM, or it could be some other such organization.
But the point is, it needs to be the same organization that publishes the UOM. That was my point.
I, with all due respect, gentlemen, I believe we are in fact discussing the issue we wish to raise and discuss in the workshop.
Okay.
Right. Let's not go into the discussion, but Mark.
I mean, I think the discussion has brought to light a number of bullets that I want to put on the slide when I bring. in that sense, it's very good. I mean, I'm very happy to have all of that. But at the same time, I mean, we don't need to resolve this. I think the whole point is that the workshop should in fact resolve this. And but we now know at least that there's a bunch of options that we can put on in front of people and deal with this. And we have this at two levels, by the way, I would point out. I mean, if we do, the problem is that it occurs at the quantity kind level and it occurs at the units level. Right? If you follow me, the meter is a measure of the quantity kind length. Okay, we can do the SI based quantity kinds. The problem is there are a lot more quantity kinds that are distinct quantity kinds. They are in the sense that the things in them are not comparable one to another. That these are distinct quantity kinds. If you have an X prime, it's not the same thing as an X. And if you compare it to an X, you have to understand exactly what you're doing when you try to do that. Right? So I'm not sure where the quantity kind break is and how you make that distinction. But there are also, and I think some of the things that Joel was just talking about fit into these, subtle quantity kind differences, because ultimately the unit for that is all going to be PSI or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, the problem, however, is there are different kinds of different kinds of PSIs, or more accurately, different kinds of pressure quantities that are explicitly identified as different quantity kinds. And I'm not sure, I mean, obviously there is a level at which if you really wanted to make the ontology useful as this sort of vocabulary, we're going to need to think about how that's going to be done. And that fits, but we couldn't possibly, and that's the point, we certainly need to deal with Pat's idea that there is some way for people to publish an extension. Whereas I think probably a maintenance agency is a way to do that, a registration authority is a way to do that as well. So those are all ways. So we get to put them up there and let people talk about it and hopefully come to an agreement. Let me think what I was looking at my next item list. So those are the first two. I mean, those are, from my point of view, the first two things we're going to hit. The third one on the list is scales. We had a number of email discussions about scales, which ultimately led nowhere, but I think that it is important. The first question is, do we understand scale as an important part of the units of measure ontology? And I think that one is more debatable than the previous two, but it seems to me that that's something we are going to have to discuss. And we are also going to need to talk about conversions between units. Those are, from my point of view, the first four issues. And then we come down to the ones that are clearly further out there. What we're going to do, if anything, about measurement and uncertainty, and what we're going to do, if anything, about the concept of specification and what goes with it, which is tolerance. And the problem in both of those cases is that the second half of each one of those
uncertainty and tolerance is an extremely complex field among the people who are experts in it. And whatever we do about that, we would, it seems to me, in one of the emails, Pat Hayes observed that if we want to be done before we die, it will be necessary for us to skirt those issues as much as possible. And I think that's probably true. The question is whether we can get away with ignoring them altogether. I know, for example, that you can see, for example, that Chip Masters' ontology and Rob Raskin's ontology both deal with, at some level, a crude measure of uncertainty. And in both cases, that's because presumably what they are talking about is measurements. Unfortunately, most of the commercial uses are specification, not measurement. And the notion that goes with that is tolerance. And most of them have some really simple-minded notion of tolerance, which may not be documented. Somehow we've got to put that out there and say, what do we want to do with this ontology? And are we just going to essentially build the groundwork and let the people who want to do specification talk about specification and tolerance as it affects them? And similarly, you can leave to NIST and its sister agencies the issue of how to officially formalize the ontologies for measurement and uncertainties. And I say sisters because there is this whole scheme of the international measurements, whatever they are, the IMS, that NIST is a member of, and the British organization isn't, amazingly enough, BSI. It's actually something like the National Physical Laboratories. Is that right, Howard? Do you know?
They are BSI members. They do actually do the standard and meter and pint.
But yeah, exactly. They are our sister. They are our sister, and so on, and so on. And so there's a bunch of those, you know. And that's the point. I mean, that's the gang that you would want. You know, the BIPM members are the people you would really want to do the measurement uncertainty stuff. My feeling is that while NIST has some expertise in this, we don't expect most of the rest of the community to, and it's certainly a very thorny subject. I mean, if you look at the size of something like the GUM, the Guide to the Expression of Uncertainty and Measurement, it's 200 pages. I mean, you know, we're not going to ontologize that. Okay, and so I think that you know, you leave that to some other gang somewhere along the way, but we do have to bring this up, so that everybody agrees that we're on, that this is the area that we're going to do this. The question with respect to specification is a little harder. I think almost everybody who's thinking to use units of measure in an ontology really does expect to be using either measures or specifications. And if we leave both of them out, I'm not sure whether, I mean, maybe that's just as well, which is the point. Maybe that is as well. And you can have naive uses that aren't clear as to what they mean, and that's probably all right. The point is that's where we have to go. We've got to raise these issues. And
it's Howard. We really do need to raise them in the context of our target market for this thing, not just the joys of technology. What do we want this ontology to do for us and for whom? And that should be a basis for sorting out the discussions. Otherwise, we're going to go straight into philosophy for a couple of hours and not get anywhere.
Exactly. And I think that is the concern that I really have, is that in order to make this thing useful to somebody, we have to decide whether our target is to stop with a naive model of quantity, and which we can do. I mean, it's all very well founded, but it's still naive in the sense that it deals with neither the concerns of measurement nor the concerns of specification. Or we can go on to some extent in some small way in one of those directions, and if we do, we have to be very sure that the small way we do isn't wrong. All right? And that it enables expansion by people who know what they're doing. And I guess that's sort of my view of it, but you're right, Howard. I mean, the issue that relates to that is what is our audience? And we could do, I mean, you know, I recently participated limitedly in the W3C Rules Interchange Forum, and their very first specification out is the so-called core. Everybody agrees the core is completely useless. The, you know, its only role is to be the common piece of two others or three others. Okay. And the problem was, as usual, you know, to get that collection of cats to agree on one common set in the center so that they could go on to do what they call the BLD, and the, which is the logic programming piece, and the PRD, which is the rules engine piece. And, you know, the we may be doing at this point only the core. I mean, that's the question, is are we developing an ontology that whose sole function is to be the first step of, and the common part of two others?
I think it's a little better than the rules people, because at least in our case, there really is a topic there. Whereas in their case, it wasn't a talk here there ever was. But never mind, move on.
Yes, well, the problem with the rules people is that there were three or four entirely different communities in there who had entirely different ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't think that's the problem that we have. So I still think we have this problem. I mean, we are going to do this. And I had a bullet left here that was referred to as priorities and micro theories. I mean, one of the issues is that if we elect to put some of these other things on our plate, we have to deal with the issue that somebody raised a while back that says we want to be done in a certain length of time. So there are certain things which we will address if we have time to do that, or we will address them if something meaningful has been done by the time we need to publish. And if it is, if that doesn't happen, it won't hurt us to lose those. And I don't want to deal with and the micro theory thing is essentially just is John Sower's idea that some of the extensions of this might be incompatible with others, and that of course is true, but I think we do have to address that in some sense, that if we do talk about allowing people, you know, allowing extensions that would be reference extensions, you do have to realize that it may well be that you can't always use two of them together. And that's just a minor issue. And that goes back to this issue that I think Pat and Howard raised, which is that if we want to start talking about, you know, sort of authorized extensions or something, extensions that use this properly or however we want to talk about that, we need to provide some kind of guideline for what that means. Okay, so anyway, I think I've said my piece. That's the list. I have a couple more things that are down there in the maybe I'll put them on the slide and maybe not. There are some things that showed up in the email that are further down the way, and I think they're pretty minor issues, and I sort of tend to leave them alone. But I did want to, I will expand a bit on what the units only quantities and units on the specific named units and specific named quantity type stuff is. Well, those are issues. And some of the issues that show up under conversions.
Yeah. Peter Yim here. One question before we move on to the next item, which we should, because we are like half an hour into the session already, is by October 30th, would you have some sort of English draft of the standard, or at the minimum, maybe the table, a table of content whereby the sections are clearly defined so that we could sort of split up the job?
Well, we could, Peter. That's not what I'm worried about. I mean, that's a different issue. Okay, that comes down to whether we're going to have a document. Okay, it seems to me that if you have a table of contents in which there are, you know, 12 chapters that are under the treatment, has what, 7, 8 chapters that have headings on which we haven't agreed as to whether that chapter is going to be there. You can have the heading, but it won't do you much good to have text in it.
I mean, that's fine. I think that the table of content in section headings is sort of one thing that would help drive this forward, because by the time we leave the October 30th workshop, at least then we would have reduced the task to smaller pieces that are coherent, or that could be coherent.
Well, I guess, guys, if we were all agreed on what you want to see, I mean, we can talk about this in the email, except that next week is going to be hard for people. If we were all agreed on what these, on the answers to some of these scope issues, then it would become clearer what those headings should be, and there are a couple of them, and I, for example, do we all agree that we need a quantities model? And
I mean, since you said, I mean, there's only one person who, I mean, it's not totally in favor. He, I mean, I don't think they sort of blatantly object either.
Okay.
For this effort. So we might as well just assume that into the draft, unless someone stands up and say no. I mean, that has to go.
Yeah, this is Steve. I would agree with that. I think we need to put some straw man positions out there, and then people can push back on them if necessary.
Okay,
absolutely.
Well, then.
Please.
Then I think that there are obviously things we're going to need to do. Well, okay, we can put some straw man positions out there through the question of yes, we need a quantities model. I've been assuming we do. Okay, yes, we need a quantities model. There are some sub issues in there that we'll deal with. And clearly we need to deal with the idea of quantity kind in that case. And we have this idea system of quantities, and I'm just going to assume that that's going to be in there. I mean, this is in the Leal diagrams as it is. It's in the Vim and so on and so forth. And that gives you base quantity and derived quantity, and then we're off into how you deal with derived quantities, which is going to be one of the questions. But that isn't how we do it is not the question of whether it should be there. All right, so we can do that. Then you come to the issue of explicit quantities. Are we going to have them? Are we not going to have them? And we're certainly going to have the SI-based quantities. Are we going to have any others? That's the kind of question we go there that are explicit models. And then we go on into the, you know, so I can do all of that, yes. When I get to things like scales and conversion, I mean, I think scales are going to be in. There's a number of emails that were exchanged on the subject of scales, and there's a lot of issues about scales. But there's issues. I mean, the scope is going to include scales, and the issues are going to be the technical issues to be resolved. And I think the same problem exists with conversion. Conversion is in. We're going to have to talk about conversion between units. We're going to make a chapter for that, but the content of that chapter is not yet very well defined. There's going to be a lot of argument about those things. The questions probably that are really open are these things at the end, which is measurement and uncertainty, specification and tolerance, and last but not least, what I would call extension. And that's probably not last. There's probably some others that I haven't yet found going through the emails, but it seems to me those are all the major ones. So, I mean, we can create these chapter headings for those things as part of the draft and then have a discussion as to whether those last two chapters have anything in them. Okay. And we generally agree that all the others will. I mean, I think in that case we can have a draft. A draft at least that puts all the headings out there. Or is that what you guys want? Is that what you want, Peter? Is that what you guys want? This is the question.
If you ask me, I think that would be perfect. Yeah.
I think it would be very useful, yes.
Okay, then we can do that. Okay, yeah, then we will certainly have that, and there will be slides to match the headings so we can, as we raise the issues. But at the scope issues level, the question is whether, you know, is to just settle on whether everybody likes those headings and wants them in the document. And if there are some of the headings toward the far end of that that go out of the document, well, then they do. I mean, that's the agreement.
That's great.
Okay, I think I'm done, I hope.
Great. Moving on to David Leo. He's got most of his stuff documented. He presented it a few weeks ago, and I don't think there's a lot to argue about. Do people see that there are needs for updates to whatever he has already put out, I mean, by way of discussions on the list or just now, or is he done? Pretty much. Comment?
We only discuss content, right?
Right, content. No particular comments. Then, I guess moving on to, I assume he's pretty much done then. And moving on to Rob Raskin and Chip Masters. Rob and Chip, I forwarded their message to a few guys here, and they said, I mean, they did talk, but they don't know where to start. And I suggested back that if Ed has a table of content and section headings, maybe that's a better way to get them started. I mean, they've got all the content material. It's just organizing them to fit into the standard. I beg your pardon?
Sorry. I wasn't as muted as I thought I was.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess, Ed, if your table of content, even draft versions of that, if you throw that out onto the list, that would help guide their work between now and the 30th, actually. Even when it's not totally tied down, at least
whatever
then they could use
that. Be out there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good, great. So the sooner the better. Then they could sort of zero in.
One other thing, Peter, just in passing while I'm at it, the OMG approved the specification that has the QUDV in it. So I extracted the QUDV, and it isn't published yet by OMG, but it will be within a couple of months. The text is fixed, so it'll be published, and it's approved, so it'll be published. So, and it's openly available, so we don't have a copyright issue. I mean, I can certainly circulate the document as long as it's got the accreditation to OMG, and it does. So what I did was excerpt the section that is the QUDV. It's PDF. Where do I put it? Is there some place to put that out there in our reference specifications list?
Email it to Joel and myself. We'll deal with that. I mean, it's just the beginning, it's probably some teething problems until we get figured out how we're going to do it. Email to both of us, and we'll take care of posting it. And then after a little bit, then we'll know the exact process that might work, and then we'll let everyone know, probably by the 30th or something.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. By the way, I mean, that's a good point. Elisa Kendall was presenting at an Ontolog forum, but mainly on OOR, but did mention QUDV. I at that very moment, I wanted to make a comment, and I lost my internet connection, and I couldn't do it. I think should we try to get an OMG person, especially someone who had actually done work on QUDV, to join us on October 30th? Would that be someone from NIST? I mean, people like Evan or...
No, but nobody at NIST actually worked on QUDV. The two leads on this are one of the JPL guys, Nicolas Roquette, and Roger Burkhart of John Deere. Burkhart may actually be at the web conference. I'll talk to Roger. I'm pretty sure that Roquette won't.
Yeah, Roquette was a very active member at Ontolog like 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So he might be there. I mean, I didn't realize that he might well be at Semlin. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he might well be there. I mean, could you make a point?
Check with both of them.
Shoot an email to all of them with a copy to, let's say, the admin list, and then we could all find out where things stand.
Okay, sure.
I did talk to Rob on the phone, and I asked him whether he's aware of QUDV, and he said he doesn't. And I said it comes out of JPL. At that time, the Nicolas Roquette didn't come up, didn't sort of flash in my mind. And so of course I didn't know what QUDV was at that time. So, by all means, please, then at least since, Rob is also...
I'll copy Rob on that.
you copy the whole list. Okay, when they respond, since they don't, Nicholas or John Deere person is not on the admin list. I mean, when they reply, they may not be their copy to the list may be may bounce. But then if you continue to reply them, then we can see their responses.
Yeah, the John Deere guy, by the way, is Roger Burkhart. He's been around.
Oh yeah, Burkhart has been on all our calls. Yeah, Nicholas has not.
Okay, right. So I figured you would know the name. Yes, exactly. These people are unknown to us. This is a small world.
Right. yes. Great. So if one of them could join us, that would be wonderful, especially when we're using their work. Yeah, we want them to have ownership. Yeah. All right. right? Going that's great. Pat, where do we stand on Cliff?
Well, where do we stand on Cliff? I guess my I have to apologize for not. I thought I had more spare time this week, but as someone said earlier, yesterday went away, and today is going the same. I had hope. I guess what my role in as a sort of Cliff guy, it seems to me, is to take what people are saying and render it into Cliff as, you know, as logically, coherently as I can. And that's what I'm setting out to try and do. Now, there are going to be a few places where there are going to be alternative ways of doing something. And I guess I will try and point out those and, you know, if they're, and what the consequences that, that they might have. In some cases, there's ways of doing things elegantly in Cliff that don't translate so easily into OWL, for example, and doing the same thing or something very close to the same thing rather less elegantly in Cliff, but more making it more similar to the OWL. And that's actually a kind of an issue for the Cliff representation. I mean, should we use Cliff in on its own terms, using it as effectively as we can to nail down meanings, or should we use it basically as, or think of it as the sort of normative core that immediately gets translated into a more, how should I put it, computationally nailed down formalism like UML or OWL in order to get actually used? Because if the latter, then that actually tends to suggest that it would be a good idea to bear in mind those translations, you know, from the get-go. I guess this is a question about the kind of perceived role of the Cliff representation in this whole effort that I'm not quite clear about myself, so I'd appreciate feedback from others.
This is Joel. What's the projected user base of the two? And, you know, of everybody that's going to be taking the standard and reading it and then trying to apply it in real life, what are they going to latch onto as the most recognizable, the OWL stuff or the Cliff stuff?
I guess it depends on where you come from.
But that's right. It depends on where you come from. I mean, for a large number of people, I suspect anything that isn't written in the UML diagram is going to be incomprehensible.
Anyway.
I mean, sorry, that came across rather snarky. But I mean,
no, that's actually right. I mean, absolutely.
And that's part of the reason for having the UML diagrams. I mean, at least if they can look at the picture and understand what it's about. The rest, if they take the rest on blind faith, you know, that's great. I mean.
So it's going to start with UML as sort of the most superficial view of what this means, and then move into OWL, which is more specific, and then move into Cliff for the people that really care.
No, I don't think it's going to be quite that. I think it's that the OWL is going to be definitive for a certain group of users, people who are, you know, if you're interested in doing something on the semantic web or nearby the semantic web or under a manager who thinks the semantic web is the best thing since sliced bread or whatever. If you're under a constraint to use that field's tools, then the OWL is going to be of central importance to you because that's going to be the files you actually will be producing will be written in OWL and so forth. And you'll be worrying about what various OWL engines can or cannot handle and OWL parser, so that would be sort of like the programming language of choice. For others, the UML will be that, in fact. But then I think that there are going to be, for people, for example, if we were to go through this idea of coming up with a sort of extendability mechanism, then I suspect that we will have to do that at the Cliff level. In other words, the people who wanted formally define extensions to the ontology and have them be ontologies of the same general stripe will have to do it initially in Cliff and then arrange that the other parts of what they do fit that.
My comment, Peter Yim here. I think we deep down inside, we probably want Cliff to do it its own way so that we have the most expressive mechanism to represent these things. And if anyone can mitigate the situation so that we don't offend the owl community, I think, Pat, you would be the person who can propose something.
Yes, I hear you. I also so much the political question of sort of not offending, or more just I'm just thinking of the poor guys who have to do the actual grunt work of using one of these things or building tools that conform. Some of them will find it vastly easier to sort of stay in the owl world as far as they possibly can, because there are tools available and there's a whole methodology, I suppose, of ways of checking conformity and so forth that are available in that world. And the same is probably true in the UML world, which I'm not nearly so familiar with. And you know, if people build any other formulas, for example, the system of there are people who are using XML based notations that are more ad hoc, but then I think some of those will want to map to our notations or map from them rather. However, I know this is a little bit of a side. One of the points about writing a Cliff formalization is that Cliff is so expressive that it's, you know, virtually anything anybody wants can be sort of jotted down in a few axioms. In some ways that's good. In other ways it's a little it illustrates the expressibility gap between Cliff and other notations, because very often I think it's the limitations on expressivity and other notations that account for a great deal of the work and complication. If we want frameworks or types of quantity measurement and so forth, or quantity types, that's no problem in Cliff. We just introduce, you know, predicates on quantities and so forth. It's kind of routine almost. So this is one of the reasons I'm sounding a bit blasé, but I'm reasonably confident of being able to knock out a Cliff ontology that suits people's prejudices as long as the intuitions are reasonably clear fairly quickly.
Pat?
Do you follow Frank? Yes. Frank.
There is this question when we start talking about units conversions about arithmetic.
Right.
Well, standard first-order logic doesn't include any arithmetic, and I think there was some mention that you had some ideas on how to skirt this problem. And
well, we don't need to axiomatize arithmetic in order to use it. I mean, Cliffs provides numerals, not. It doesn't provide reals, but it provides numerals, and I think we can simply assume that we have, you know, functions called plus and times and so forth available in the logic, and without needing to axiomatize them, we simply assert they mean what they usually mean. And of course, any implementation, I mean, that's good enough for a normative standard, and any implementation that uses these will obviously interpret them in the appropriate way. I mean, because we're talking about multiplication addition on integers, so on natural numbers, so there's really there's no gray area there. If we start talking about continuous quantities involved in reals, we will have to specify, we'll have to invent an appropriate notational scheme and specify what it means exactly. But again, I think we can do that without necessarily axiomatizing it.
Okay, because I had thought we also were only dealing with the exponents of these things, essentially ratios of polynomials in the base units or base dimensions. But apparently there are some systems of units in which in some problems in electromagnetism you have to take the square root, which takes us away, well away from our standard simple ratios of polynomials in the basis dimension.
Right. I mean, I guess my intuition is that what the logic should do is assume perfect precision. In other words, that it should talk about, we can introduce a square root function simply as a function. And someone objects, but how do you specify the square root of 3? You know, you need infinite amounts of data. And the answer is, well, we're simply talking about the actual number. We're not worrying about how to nail it down with enough precision for particular purposes. Now, that's not very helpful to someone who has to deal with rounding errors in conversions. If we want to get into that, I think that would get more complicated in the logic. We would have to have an ontology of errors and ranges and such things, which has not been done, and we would need to do it.
I'm hoping we can, at least in version 1, we can avoid those sorts of questions.
I agree. I mean, I think
Ed, you're still on the line.
Yeah, I was like keyboarding what you guys are talking about.
Oh, bless you.
For those, okay. I mean, Pat's quite right. I don't know that anybody has done an ontology for floating for floating point arithmetic and all of its friends. And my recollection is that there was a lot of very formal work done on that, probably by Kahn. In around 1990, it might be possible to, you know, turn some of that into an ontology, but, you know, we don't really want to go into the arithmetic. I really think we want to, you know, and I agree with Pat. I think we want to assume mathematically perfect numbers and, well, that's not the right word, but, you know, mathematically correct numbers and not worry about their representability. I mean, I realize that this is a serious problem. If you look at what Al did with data types for all practical purposes, I mean, their data types, their data, they don't have real, you know, their data type is double. Their solution is to bag it and say, you know, all these are going to be computational anyway. We're talking about double division floating point. But in fact, they just kind of assume that somebody else will have defined the arithmetic rules for that. And of course, it does conform to IEEE 753. So,
yeah, I don't want to reinvent that.
Yeah, we don't want to try to formulate that.
And no, I agree. You know, the other thing is that one can follow what the OWL world has done and appeal to a set of data types. You know, and then the definers of the data types have to deal with questions of identity relative to 64-bit precision or whatever. And one simply in the logic refers to that these entities are defined by the data type rules. And I think it's actually quite a good way of separating out the issues and sort of putting them into different boxes.
We could
refer to the XFD data types in common logic perfectly well.
Okay. They just wave their hands and say, look at
they wave and jump up and down a little bit. They do their best. But you know, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, the we can't do everything, and that's a well-known area of murkiness, of which a lot of people have thought very hard about and have come up with systems for dealing with in practice. And we can simply refer to them, I think, and utilize them, knowing that the result is going to be problematic at certain points. You know, and right at boundaries of precisions are going to be issues that people are going to have to deal with, and we're not dealing with those issues, and we're kind of open about that.
That's great.
So I haven't said anything about common logic other than, yeah, it can express just about anything. I apologize for it. I'd hope to have some actual examples ready for this meeting, but I'll certainly have them ready for the 30th, and I'll circulate them by email in advance.
Fantastic. Sounds great. You circulated back into the general list, not the admin list. I mean, the admin list should deal with the coordination planning meta conversation, and the content issues should be on the UOM ontology standard list.
Okay, sure.
Yep. Great. Moving on to Howard, who is much more ready than most of us.
I've made no further changes to the TC draft because we need to pull out from the discussion
what our scope is, who's going to get involved, and so on. I've sent a copy of that draft scope to Jamie, so he's got a clear view of what, where we've got to and what else needs to go in there. And I'm trying to set him up with a five-minute view of the OASIS procedure, so that we've got the basis for at least deciding we're going down that route.
Sounds great. I have one question. You probably might have considered QUOM in lieu of, as an alternative or as a candidate for QUOMOS?
No, I hadn't. QUOMOS is an arbitrary decision. It can be changed.
Right. It just sounded a bit long. I mean, of course, I have no objection to it either.
It's a lunchtime discussion. We should not let the meeting get diverted into it.
That's why I would love to get some of these things cleared on the email list, or at least line up all the candidates so that
if we can get anything coming up, that's fine.
Okay.
My only other challenge, of course, is the slot at the start on goals of the workshop, which is starting very much to sound like a couple of slides. The goals are to really identify the market, the scope, the technical features of what we want to do, and then the organization and plan for doing it. And then we can just do the brief introductory section on making sure everybody's comfortable with the agenda and take them through that in order to hopefully structure the day. People are comfortable with that. I'll try and knock out some slides. It won't be till Tuesday next week.
Sounds great. We don't meet until Friday next week.
Well, it's an 8 o'clock start, and I'll be there at 8. I'm around the corner. But if people are comfortable with that structure, that should then get. My aim there is to ensure that if we can pull out items that will send us off into disruptive holes, and we can help people to perhaps structure their thoughts on issues so we don't get crossover between our target market, the scope, the technical features, and so on.
That's great.
Other comments?
I'll obviously ping back to the admin list when I hear back from Jamie, because he'll only just be up, won't he? Let me just check to see if we've heard back. No, I haven't heard back from him yet.
All right. Then moving on to Joel, who is the only person with a set of slides.
Somebody comes prepared.
Right. Let me sort of put the Joel's slide. Okay, I just sent this slide over. It will also be flashed on the shared screen if you go on the shared screen. If not, bring it up on your desktop, and Joel will walk us quickly through where we stand on the project administration.
They're on the
shared screen, on the VNC, as well as on
He has a link actually under slides, and it gets you slides, amazingly enough.
Yeah, I pulled it off. It's a bit of a scramble, but I figured it out.
All yours, Joel.
Okay. All right, so this is sort of a repeat of what I talked about on Monday, expanded a little bit, and I wasn't quite sure what the target audience was going to be today, but as it turns out, at least half of you have already seen some of this in a slightly different form. Okay, page two. Slide two. So what, you know, the other standards work that I've been involved in was with the American Society for Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers. And that had that effort had started in the early 1980s, took about 13 years, a little more than that, to complete. It came out with a standard that's now about 700 pages and had an enormous number of committee members and contributors over the years. So I had, I guess, sort of assumed that all standards organizations and ways of creating a standard were going to follow in that model. So that's probably a little off. I've learned a lot since then. So page three. What was lacking before, and you know, this is from the early 1980s to the mid 90s, that we didn't have any email discussion lists or wikis to be able to do collaborative editing. It was very difficult to get the group to agree on what the scope was going to be. A lot like what I anticipate some of the scope discussions are going to be at the workshop, but in this case, it was much worse. There was most of the people that were assigned to be members of the committees were not domain experts. They were people within organizations that had some time to kill, that were sent to contribute to the meeting. But because they really didn't know what they were talking about, it took quite a while to educate them up to the level that was necessary to be able to have a meaningful discussion. So there was, and not all of the members that actually attended the committee meetings were there to make sure that it succeeded. They were actively involved in, you know, contributing content and forcing discussions that slowed the process down. So that's what you know, this group is very much motivated to succeed, and that's wonderful to see. So anyway, on the administration side of that standard, the document sharing, this is page three. Page four, I'm sorry, was document sharing, version control, knowing who had made what kinds of changes to what documents as they were being mailed around and sent around, printed off and marked up, and knowing who was going to be responsible for editing what part of which piece was kind of wild and woolly for many years. So I wanted to see if I could interject myself into this process early and try to avoid some of that. So I put together the track server, page five, and created this cute little graphic for it. Page six. The assumption is that this effort was going to be creating a lot of different kinds of documents, some for human consumption and some for actual tools, that we were going to be getting things that people could run on their system and either browse through the existing lists of units or derive their own units or whatever, but that there were going to be things that were tools for people to use as well as just plain text documents. One of the other aspects about BACnet that was interesting was the amount of reference material and supporting tutorials that people had published in a variety of different forms was very difficult to find and track down and collect together. So I wanted to have a spot where if there was some other reference material that was available, that it was all part of one repository and it was really easy for people to get up to date with the current version of the repository. That was especially important ahead of working group meetings, that everybody on the group, rather than sharing jump drives and trying to contact FTP service to be able to get the current versions of documents, that people had a really simple way of getting up to date. There also needed to be, I wanted to present a way of finding out an easy way to know what the work was to be able to achieve the next milestone. Okay, page seven. As it turns out, as I watch this, the process is moving much faster than I anticipated. I'm still in the process of collecting some content. So as you guys have things that you know, as you make contributions and you email the content to Peter and myself, then I'll be making it available into the repository. I expect a lot of stuff will be resolved at the workshop. So the things that I've itemized out as individual tickets for people to work on will probably be done inside one broad lunch discussion, and it'll be over. So
Your usage of the word ticket is not familiar to me here. Can you elaborate?
Ticket is sort of like a work issue or a work request or something that needs to be raised as an action item for somebody to work on. So if somebody creates a ticket, that's a track term within this software.
Okay.
So, yeah, as a work item, I guess it's... So as the, I expect the workshop will resolve a lot of things that I have listed out as individual items.
Have you read the requirements and rules for documentation for OASIS projects?
I have read part of them.
Because all the content loaded up on their public server, which is running a Kavi-based system.
If you have any reference material that you can send to me on how to get connected to that process, that would be great.
Go take a look at oasis-open.org.
I believe Joel has.
Yeah, there's a process button.
Yeah, Joel has gone through that process, at least scanned through it.
Joel, what kind of server do they use for this?
The Kavi system, KAVI.
Okay.
It has all the management of the memberships, and it provides structures for everybody to upload documents in a public environment.
Well, does it have an issue tracking system? We use Bugzilla for ISO 11179.
Well, we use Bugzilla for SE4 too, but that's an issue. That's a very different kind of creature. I mean, Bugzilla really is about tracking issues.
Right. Yep.
And ultimately, we'll need something like that, I think.
Well, the question is something going to be prescribed to us to use? Like, if this is going to be an OASIS project, then at least one of those documents that I read said that it had to be stored on the servers and equipment that they provide.
Right. I mean, when this work becomes OASIS, then we probably conform to most of their processes.
Okay. The other thing you need to note is that you might need something else. For example, our PLCS DEX development, we have an open source library there as well. It's on SourceForge. So it may well be that we'll need something else. You just need to make sure that it can get linked into the OASIS pages and is appropriately open.
Okay. Well, I'd be happy to, as we come across those kinds of issues, I'd be happy to work on them. In the meantime, I'll just do some background reading and see what I can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole point is that you were planning to use the track server and to get through the process at least as far as getting to have an official document that starts going through the OASIS behaviors. And the defense, I think that's an important thing. I think the question is exactly what the OASIS server will support and what they want to support. I mean, there's the issue of how much of the action we're tracking as, you know, I don't know how the OASIS thing works. I mean, I've never looked to see that. So, I mean, I can use it to find the current draft of a TC document, okay, of a TS document, but I don't know a TC document, but that's about it. I mean, I've never looked at how to, what it does about issue tracking or work item assignment or anything of that sort.
I don't think they have those. I think the strength is more on the membership management and the content management and not the process. I mean, and the process, but not the tracking of the process. And that's pretty much deferred to the
rules there about openness, and we can supplement the document repository with other stuff as required. But you do need to take account of what we have to do there. So, as I say, despite some myths to the contrary, quite a lot of the OASIS rules are actually more stringent than ISO.
I think that the kind of tools we are using are quite complementary to what they are using, which I think is great.
But I don't think there's an issue. We just need some more, need to be aware.
Right.
Yep.
Yes.
And also, and from my background, I knew that ASHRAE still has nothing at all to be able to do anything. So, you know, that's all left up to the standards project committees of these, of, you know, their standards to handle internally. So it's quite curious. So, okay.
Yeah, the real trick for the OASIS side is the drafts that reach, the drafts that are, you know, in some sense, officially signed off at certain points in the process need to go up to OASIS with all the trappings.
Okay.
I mean, in some sense, they're also duplicating things that we may have some intermediate forms for. But, I mean, and my experience, by the way, is that in that regard, OASIS and OMG are rather similar. If you go to the OMG work in process page, you end up finding that what you've got is this chart that tells you where the technical process is and what the most recent formal step draft of this thing is. It's like tracing ISO CDs and things. You know, this is where we are in the formal process, and here's the last document. But you can find a situation in which there's an active task, and the last formal publication is a year and a half ago. Right,
yeah, okay.
Because they've been working, but they're working inside of a working group that is doing it just like we are, you know, somewhere offline, and you have to get connected to the group to find out what the current state really is. So, I mean, it's unfortunate, but the process is defined that way, and OASIS TCs have regular meetings, so you have regular you have regular reporting requirements, and those things show up on the site.
Okay.
But that's, you know, that's analogous to having a progress report a lot of the time.
Okay, guys, I'm going to drop off the call now, but we'll be in touch by email.
Okay, can you hold on for maybe a couple of more minutes? Because I have a fairly important question. Howard?
Okay.
Yes. Excuse me, Joel, can I slip this in before Howard?
Yeah, absolutely, go ahead.
Yeah, once, it's unfortunate that Steve has left, but I had a conversation with him, and he brought up a point which I think is very valid. He said the major challenge is not our content, but getting sort of ownership from the old gods, I mean, in the standards world. And since we have Howard here, he can tell us whether we are sort of safely embraced by the old gods. To that end, Steve actually had made an attempt to invite Chuck Ehrlich to join us.
Who's Chuck Ehrlich?
NIST people would probably know more. Ed, do you?
I know what he means. Yeah. Chuck Ehrlich is a BIPM person.
Yes.
So you're talking about the TC25 times, Howard. That's what he really means.
Yeah, I tried to send an email to the I sent emails to the guys in charge at BIPM, who's a learned professor who did not want to deal with any sort of trivia such as standard ontologies. I think there is a very high risk here of getting some pushback. What I've done, though, is circulated the links to this to the MOU management group, which includes ISOCS and IEC Central Office, with a request for them to take note of it. We could well get some pushback. What we're not trying to do is generate new units. We're trying to generate, a derivative product based on the existing standards.
But we also want the ontologies to be a first-class citizen on that standard, which is the challenge, actually. I mean,
we have a massive activity of convincing people that the ontology is going to be valid. It will not become the master for a long time.
Right.
But it will become the master electronic record, hopefully. But until we've got one, it's going to be very difficult to attract their attention because, frankly, they are very traditional standardizers.
Absolutely. And
we're not going to win a frontal assault.
Right, right. And Steve did say, I mean, they're extremely conservative.
Right.
Yeah, but the good thing is, at least Chuck Garlick went back to Steve. I mean, Steve actually invited him to join us on this call, the 10/22nd, and be at the workshop. And he said, I mean, it turns out it was unfortunate that he is traveling. He almost meant to send a colleague, but he said, unfortunately, the other colleague I mentioned is even more unavailable than he is. But he said he will sort of check back on our telephone conference and on the workshop. So at least from Steve's perspective, he's trying to build a friend out of Chuck Ehrlich in this effort, and hopefully we need, and I guess Howard is already doing sort of similar things on his front. I guess we need as much as that done. Otherwise,
I've got a more positive response from the British Standards guy, so committee secretary, who may well be able to insinuate this into us. But I would not preclude us getting the equivalent of a cease and desist request. Which is why we need to be very sure of what our market is and why they're not doing it. And then perhaps convince them that it's a good idea for us to deliver a new form of what they have already agreed. Because we're not going to do new agreements, and we've said very explicitly in the charter, I've been very careful to say that where we have disputes over the actual facts, actions, and relationships, we'll bounce those back to the guys who are responsible for them. Because one of the advantages, of course, of using an ontological approach is that it flags up those inconsistencies.
Okay.
And we're not going to solve those.
Right. I think one of the best ways to get them to have some ownership is to have them join us at the workshop. So please.
That would be nice, but we tried that on the previous calls, and had a very terse response. Let's put it that way.
I think, Peter, that we are too early. I think that the situation is that when we have a draft document that we can run by these folk, okay, that will give them a much clearer picture of what we are doing and how it relates to what they have done, and whether they have problems with it. And until and unless we have something to show, as far as they're concerned, we might be yet another academic body screwing around in the wilderness, and they don't really care.
That's
okay?
One way to
think
about it.
They're not going to care unless we have a product that is threatening to become a standard. And at that point, as Howard says, you know, if we are far enough away from what they expect, we can surely get a cease and desist. If we're very close, we might get their support and cooperation in fixing it.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. And the other way the way I tend to look at it is if we involve them early in the game and they are part of these decisions on incorporating X and not incorporating Y and what is in scope, what is out of scope, we have a better chance of getting their buy-in than when we are really challenging them because we are close enough to becoming standard, I mean, through the OASIS process.
And I think, Peter, the trouble is that assumes that they're motivated to even pay us any attention at all, and right now some of them are not. I mean, and there's no reason why they should be, because we haven't proved that we're going to do anything yet.
But when we get a document out that is, I use the term document in the broadest sense, in the OASIS environment, it has to go for public review, not an internal review. We are required to consult or to make the document publicly available, and we can flag up to everyone that we are concerned about at that time that here is a document.
Yeah.
Now is your time to comment.
That's right. That's the time.
Right.
But we need to have something that, while it would be ideal to have them involved in the process, we have to be credible because they are, as has been said, traditional, good old-fashioned standardizers. They have the high ground because they have got the standards. All we're doing is an alternate representation, effectively.
Okay.
Agreed.
Yep.
I have to go, but one just thought on this discussion. I mean, the active buzzword in semantics and web circles now is linked data, where the idea is you don't set out to redo, replace, or in any way alter existing bodies of data. What you do is rather provide semantically meaningful links to them.
Right.
And I think if we sort of were to cast ourselves as playing that kind of a role at some conceptual level, that we're not building a new standard so much as building a kind of network that connects all these existing standards coherently, that might be a better sales pitch. And on that
yeah,
note,
it's
I
derivative work from a bunch of existing stuff, which could be used.
Yes.
And the benefits to them is further reinforces their control of the basic facts and just represents them in a different form.
Let's build those language into whatever we're putting out there. Okay, so maybe, sorry Joel, back to you.
Sorry guys, I've got to drop off now.
Yeah.
But,
thank
you,
Howard.
Thank you, Howard. Okay.
Reality.
Page 8.
Oh,
no, we're done with reality.
We're done with reality.
Yeah, we dealt with reality for a moment.
down to problems that I know how to solve. No, it's funny to have to listen to these conversations because the same thing happens in lots of other standards organizations. Anyway, the current milestones that I created in the server is for this conference call and the workshop. And the next two would be the collection of the stuff that actually gets forwarded to the TC administrator for approval of the TC formation. Page 9. On Monday, I'd requested the admin mailing list so that I could send out, you know, announcements of, you know, server uptimes and downtimes, and, you know, who's been, you know, what kinds of things have been committed and what kinds of tickets have been created and that kind of thing. Thank you very much, Peter. Page 10. My mission for today was to collect drafts of the components and create tickets out of the individual components that were still missing and open up the track site for comments. Page 11. At the time before the workshop was about to commence, take a look at the things that were still listed as having to be done or where the content needed to be reviewed, and then present that to the conference organizers for the update of the agenda. I think at this point that's probably not going to happen because I don't think we're far enough in the process to get down into I really expect the scope discussion to overwhelm anything that might be, you know, an action item from a specific ticket. Once a standard goes into maintenance mode, then this becomes a lot more important. But at this point, it's not necessarily as important. Page 12. So the draft that Howard sent is available on the wiki. And in fact, if you go to, let's see if I can get my chat window back over here. If you can go to this page in the chat room, which is that charter draft down to section 2B, date, time, and location of the first meeting. Okay. People see that?
Yeah.
You'll notice that right below that, I put in bold, to be determined, you know, it was, Howard had written to be determined at the October 30 meeting, and then I put the purple track link next to it. So if you click on that track link and open it up in a new window, then you can see the ticket that I created on the track server that matches that.
Owned by somebody.
Oh, good. I'm sorry, Joel, I didn't follow that.
There's where it says action TBD at October 30 meeting on the wiki page for the Ontolog wiki page.
Yeah, if you go to the chat window,
I was on the charter page.
The
charter draft page.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Scroll down to section 2B.
If you click on Joel's link.
Action TBD, got it, okay.
Okay.
Oh, and a track, I see.
Okay, right next to that, there's a little track link. And if you click on that, you'll go to the ticket as it exists in the track server related to that action.
Ah, look at that. I see.
Okay, so now on that track ticket, you can see where it says milestone. It says UOM workshop. There's a hyperlink there, a milestone. Okay, and if you click on that, then it's a description of the milestone itself. And within that, you'll notice that 0% of the tickets have been closed. They're all active.
Right.
And if you click on the active ticket link, then you'll get a list that I also displayed in the slide of all the active tickets for that milestone. So anyway, that's kind of the
pieces of the charter draft. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, and every one of the, you know, in each one of those pieces is in the charter draft. So if somebody says that they're, you know, finding all the contact list information is somebody's job to do, but they're not going to do at the meeting, but they're going to do later, then I would update the ticket to say that that person is responsible for that particular ticket. And then when they contact me, I can clear the ticket out and update the charter. So that's sort of what I would be doing as a, on the administration side to help move the process forward.
Great.
Oh, this is actually pretty neat. Yeah, this is a very thorough electronic management system. Well, to the extent that people actually fill in the blanks.
Right, and the question is, you know, as we get further along in the process, and I have more things that I can reference. Then I can make more and more focused tickets on, you know, so that people can say, what are all the open tickets for a particular component? Pat Hayes, you know, if you send me some Cliff stuff, then I'll add it to the repository, and then we can make that a component of this whole work. And then if people have questions about it, then I can create tickets related specifically to that. And then set a milestone as, you know, maybe the next face-to-face meeting is when the completion event needs to happen. I mean, usually, for the work that I do with ASHRAE, the milestones are sort of the next full committee meeting. And there are four meetings throughout the year, the full committee meeting being two of those. And then the alternate meetings are working group meetings. So that's kind of the way the process works there. And I've tried to sort of match that.
Looks good. Is that it?
That's it. That's what I have.
Okay. So back to Frank and Ed. Concluding remarks.
No, I've been adding revised instructions and directions to the site, and also revised instructions for handling laptops.
Okay.
And connecting to the wireless network. We will have wired Ethernet ports for about 24 people, and power at the conference table, and everyone else will be sitting around the walls. And they will have to connect up to the the wireless network, and they'll have to go to room 357 to get the password for the wireless network. But we don't have 24 people signed up. And so if we're under 24 people, everyone could just sit at the conference table, and assuming they bring their own Ethernet cable, they can patch into Ethernet ports that pop up directly from the conference table.
Yeah, sounds good.
And we will have an audio technician there to help us with audio-visual stuff. There's a projection screen there, and we will be able to connect into the dial-up number so that people can come in by teleconference. And I'm assuming Peter probably will come early so we can get that set up.
Yep, I'll come early if they'll let me in.
There should be a badge waiting for you. Everyone who's on the list is being registered has badges waiting for them as they walk in.
Will you be at ISWIC by any chance?
I will be at Owl ED and ISWIC, assuming I don't get derailed.
All right. See you then.
Unfortunately, a couple hours in ISWIC on Tuesday due to a group meeting that we're having that I'm supposed to come in by teleconference.
Yeah. Okay. I know. Joel, you'll not be there. Ed, are you going to be at ISWIC?
I'm registered, but I'm not sure how much of it I'm going to be there for. I have a number of deliverables that I need to finish by the 30th. So having lost 2 days this week, I figure that I'm going to be doing all the running I can to stay in one place. I will probably make the end of the week, but I don't know. I probably will not be there before Wednesday.
Okay. And we know
Evan going to be there, do you know?
Evan will be an Owl Ed tomorrow. Or is that tomorrow?
Yeah.
And Evan will be at Owl Ed, and he'll be there much of the week for various things.
Yeah, this place is a pain to get to by public transport.
Yeah, and Pat will definitely be there because Pat is a keynote speaker for ISWIC.
So I think we're okay with respect to logistics and stuff.
Hmm.
Peter can take a look at what I've done to the web page.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Looks great.
Okay.
All right. So I guess that sort of prepares us for October 30th. And until then, let's continue to chat and communicate over the two mailing lists. Content on the UOM ontology standard list and the administrative conversation on the UOM ontology admin list.
Okay. Then one last thing for you, Peter. I did contact John.
Stop. Yeah.
And you weren't able to reach him because he was in panels earlier this week, but he's out of panels. He's here.
Great. I will try to
today,
get him a call. Right. I'll try to get him a call right after this. Okay. And also one thing for Ed. I noticed that your Ed Bach in the official Edward Bachmeier name.
I'm both.
Right.
Yes.
So
NIST adopted, Edward.Bachmeier, that form, finally, with a central server sometime in the 1990s, and at that point that became my official NIST thing. And I have never used it, but I am now being forced to use a central mail server that does not seem to be able to identify me as anything else, no matter what I set my reply to. The problem is
you're being hammered into submission.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the problem is that I've been Ed Bach at NIST.gov for 30 years. Ed Bach had something at NIST.gov for 30 years. I mean, you know, I was an ARPANET person, so we had email back in the 70s.
I'll have to resubscribe you. That's exactly why I asked people to respond back to the list to test it out, and you didn't. And you actually responded back to the CIM3 admin, but at least I noticed the change in the email address, so I'll have to resubscribe you. Like I had
as both. You probably have to subscribe me as both because God knows which one you can't.
I'll officially subscribe you on. Okay. I can just sort of put an alias and accept anything that comes from Edward Bachmeier. Then. Okay, that makes it.
I have one question for you, Peter.
Yes, by all means.
Is there a separate login ID for the teleconference number other than that conference ID for the conference organizer of the teleconference?
No.
No. Just whoever does it first?
Not even. I mean, there's a setting I can do whether the conference will start after the organizer gets in, or I can even set it so that any two people can start the conference. Do you see what I mean?
Okay, so we don't have to do anything special other than that, and you'll be there to help.
Right, right, right. As long as, I mean, your NSF dials into that number. I usually set it so that anyone can dial and start a conference without waiting for me, for example. I mean,
okay,
myself being the organizer. And I don't see changing it that for that day. So any two people calling in will get the conference started.
Okay. And somebody, well, I think we have a computer there that we can put presentations on to project them.
Sounds great. But I would still love to have people send in their slides beforehand
so that they
could be available on the agenda page, because a lot of people won't be able to access the shared screen server for one reason or another. And it's always nice that they can run it on their own desktop and against the prompt of the speaker to advance the slides.
And Peter, are you expecting a lot of other people so far, or this is going to be a nice small meeting?
It's a nice small meeting. If you look at the registration page, it's up to date on who we are expecting.
Okay, so it looks like we've got like 8 people or something in person and another half, 4 or 5 people online.
Right.
Wow, okay, that's actually manageable.
Yeah.
But if we've only got about 8 people in person.
Not more than 8.
Pretty much the management committee is the whole committee. Is that the way it works?
No, I count 10 people on site now. I guess at the end of the day, we probably have a couple more. Yeah. And
we'll pick up people during the ISWC, maybe.
Yeah,
but perhaps.
Yeah, but okay. Essentially, if you read the fine print, anyone who's not really here are only observers. And when you run the meeting, Frank and Ed and Howard, I mean, you can always say, I mean, we're taking notes from the active members, because we don't want the observers to come in and sort of skew the votes. I mean, if we had to vote on anything.
You want to vote something on voting rules?
No.
Saying that if they haven't been active in the previous teleconferences, they don't vote?
No, I don't think that. I mean, that's not fair. If you get somebody you really want, that makes a difference. And then you have the problem of, you know, you can't say A but not B. I think really the question is how many people are in the room. I mean, if it turns out that you end up with, you know, 8 or 10 registered participants and 5 more people on the telephone, that's a manageable number. And anybody else in the room probably is an observer. But on the other hand, if you've only got 2 more people in the room, there's no reason not to include them.
Right.
What I'm more worried about is that the thing I want to avoid is having to spend a very long time doing education.
Right.
Yeah, we would have to declare early that's
not
going to happen. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We actually can't afford it.
Right. I mean, you know, if we've got some class of handouts that cover what we have discussed, and like, for example, the scope thing, it's not really an issue because the nature of the issues is going to be written down. If you don't understand what that's about, then kindly hold your peace, you know, but beyond that, I don't think that's the problem. I am worried about some of these things getting to the stage where you have people who are coming in the middle of the movie, and they can, in fact, disrupt quite a bit by asking you to cover ground that has been long since covered in, you know, the email exploder and the sort of teleconferences and so on.
Right, right.
Names, Peter?
Yes.
Maybe what you want to do where you say this session, like other Antilog events, is open to the public, maybe you want to say that people who are new to this process are strongly encouraged to read the previous web pages and and listen to some of the tape teleconferences before they come?
Yeah, I already have that language in the invitation, so people who responded should know. All right, we're done.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay.